Welcome to the Tuesday Brown Bagger, right here on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Vancouver is known as a progressive city, an example to many, but is it ready for declining oil and climate change? Will the city be able to feed itself in the future? A lively panel of politicians and candidates worked over these tough questions on October 15, 2008, at the BCIT downtown campus. And what a panel! The sitting mayor of Burnaby, Dennis Corrigan, Vancouver City Councilwoman Susan Anton, pot liberationist icon and candidate for mayor Mark Emery, Vancouver mayor candidate Gregor Robertson, and former Western Canada Wilderness head Andrea Reimer, who is seeking a council spot. Rounded out by Betty Croswick, the 80-year-old green activist just out of jail and running for mayor, and hosted by author and Greenpeace co-founder Rex Wyler. In addition to oil, food, and energy, the panelists talked down the Gateway Project, a massive freeway and bridge-building expansion brought by the provincial government in British Columbia. Let's get going as Rex Wyler introduces the evening.
My name is Rex Wyler. I'm a member of the Vancouver Peak Oil Group. We formed about 2 years ago for the purpose of although raising several environmental issues in our region. Peak oil is kind of our flagship issue, but we are also talking about global warming, peak everything, commodity throughput, how that's changing in our world. One of the what we're discovering and what we're being told by the geologists, petroleum geologists, and by the way, this is not sort of goofy science. This is fairly serious, hardcore geology. The petroleum geologists are explaining to us, and we can see from oil production figures, that production of oil has peaked and will decline. And we might think that's not necessarily a big deal. We have other alternatives. I won't go into all the details about this right now, but you can find this information on our website and also on the ASPO website. Oil drum and other sources of information. We are at the end of the era of cheap liquid fuels, and this is going to have impact on every community in the world. The scale of the human economy and the scale of the human population has now increased to the scale of the ability of the earth to supply the resources that we're using. And we see this not only in oil, we see this in copper, phosphorus, for example, for fertilizers, water, land, everything we consume. So the questions that we're now facing are, how do we plan our communities, our cities, our regions, for an era in which virtually every resource we have, every resource we rely on, we will have less of, most likely, energy particularly. Production, the global production of petroleum has increased for over 100 years until the spring of 2005. And in 2005, the global production of petroleum was about 74 million barrels per day. And for the first time in history, that production has plateaued. It's no longer increasing. Regardless of all the total liquid fuels, which includes the tar sands, biofuels, liquid natural gas, and so forth, is about 85 million barrels a day. Now, in spite of all the increases in recovery, in spite of all the increases in biofuel technology, liquid natural gas technology, and so forth, this production figure of about 85 million barrels a day has plateaued. And we have seen oil prices increased from $3 a barrel in the 1970s to, now it's currently, we've seen oil drop recently to $75, but we've also seen it up at $140. But the point is, the price of oil has increased primarily because the production has plateaued, and globally, of course, demand for these resources continues to increase exponentially. Anita Burke, who was the former senior advisor for Shell Oil, for climate change and sustainability, has said peak oil is a reality for the oil industry. We all know it. These are simply the facts of science. Oil will peak and will decline. James Schlesinger, who was the U.S. Defense Secretary and Energy Secretary, has said industry leaders all concede and understand there will be a decline in liquid fuels. The battle is over. The peakists have won. Now, here's another issue with oil that most of us, of course, aren't aware of because it's slightly technical. But back in the 1930s, it cost the industry about one barrel of oil to produce 100 barrels of oil. Today, it costs one barrel of oil to produce about 15 to 20. And in the tar sands, it's barely 2 to 1. In other words, the fuel cost, the oil cost of producing energy, the energy cost of producing energy is dropping like a stone. And as not only do we have less petroleum available, but the energy cost of getting it is falling. The peak per capita, because we understand the population is increasing, we're adding 75 million people to the planet every year. Peak oil per capita occurred in 1979. So per person on the planet, we have less energy resources every year. So if our resource use is going up in Canada, then and the resource per capita planet-wide is going down, fifth grade math class could do the math on that, that means that others are going without. And it's not only the dispossessed and the rest of the world that are going without, but future generations. And this is something that in our time, in the era of the environmental movement and awareness of the environmental limits on our economies and on our growth, that we are now literally have to think about future generations so that our lifestyle, our cities, are not essentially stealing resources or using resources that are then not going to be available to future generations. And all of us who have children and grandchildren and so forth need to think about that because we don't want to leave our children and grandchildren a planet that is degraded because of our excessive lifestyles. So, given that, we have some questions. And we've had a series of discussions here. I want to emphasize that this is not really a political debate. This is a discussion about energy in the Vancouver region. And this happens to be the political version. The last one we did was with media. We've had various groups here to talk about these issues. We're not here to settle political issues in Vancouver. We're not going to decide necessarily here tonight who's going to win or lose elections. We're here to talk about a very serious issue, and I want to thank our guests for agreeing to come here and do this. Here to my right is Suzanne Anton. She's a city councilor, and she's again running for the city council with NPA. Suzanne does a lot of wonderful things. I first crossed paths with Suzanne when my kids were little, and we wanted a turf soccer field on the west side. Suzanne was our champion in City Hall. Derek Corrigan, mayor of Burnaby, also running again for the mayoral race in Burnaby. Derek also has done many wonderful things in Burnaby, very popular. And last year, or 2 years ago, during the International Peace Forum, Derek was very helpful to that event, and everyone really appreciated that. Gregor Robertson, he was our NDP MLA from Fairview. He is now running for mayor of our city, Vancouver, with the Vision Party. Andrea Reimer is running for council, city council, with Vision. And Andrea has also been on the school board, did wonderful things on the school board, really initiated a lot of the healthy food campaigns in our city. So we're looking at a lot of people. Everyone up here has really contributed to our city, and we should all really appreciate it. Who's next there? Betty Krazak, and she has stood up for all of us in front of the bulldozers in the forest and helped preserve our wilderness. And did her time, paid dearly for that, and did her time and did that for all of us. And she's also running for mayor with the Work Less Party. And Peter Ladner sends his regrets. He had emergency dental work done today and just simply couldn't make it. Mark Emery.
I appreciate having his spot, though.
I can't really say that Mark is here filling in for Peter, but he's graciously agreed to sit in on this. Okay, so here's how this is going to work. I'm going to ask questions. I'm going to raise some questions. Each panelist is going to get to answer them. This is not really a debate. We're really interested in talking about these issues as a community, and we're not here to rag on each other or initiate political debate so much as to really talk about the issues. First, before we get started, Suzanne, maybe I'll start with you. And if each of you would just introduce yourself, just say anything you would like to say about your relationship to these issues, to environmental issues, and your sort of vision for Vancouver. And if you could keep that to about 90 seconds, about a minute and a half, just a brief introduction. Suzanne.
Thank you, Rex, and thank you, everybody, for coming tonight. It's a real pleasure to be here. I did come into politics through community sport, following a well-trodden path. May Brown, George Puhle, Philip Owen, I think, all came in through sport. But I'm also a very strong and very committed environmentalist and have been my whole life. And so it does give me a lot. It's very interesting to be on council and to be able to translate some principles into policy. Some of the things that I've been working on council are the eco-density initiative at Vancouver City Council. I've led that as a councillor, and also paid a lot of attention, of course, to our goals on greenhouse gas, our transportation plan, and things like that, which I hope I'll be able to tell you a bit more about later on. At the region, I've been on the committee chaired by Mayor Corrigan, which is the Land Use and Transportation Committee. We've been working on the new regional growth strategy, and it's been a very interesting process there, thinking about how climate change, food security, and so on translate into policy in the regional growth strategy. Still up for discussion. You'll all have a chance to weigh in on it during next year. Thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Corrigan?
Well, thank you very much. And it's one of my limited forays into Vancouver. I said I usually come in to cause trouble every few months. I am a Vancouver boy, though, as I was born in Vancouver General Hospital and raised in East Vancouver, and only went out to Burnaby when I finished my education at UBC Law School and took up articles with Jim Lorimer, who was a former NDP MLA. That's probably where I got started in politics, and eventually was elected to Burnaby Council, spent 15 years as a city councillor, and the past six as mayor. So I've had a pretty colorful career and a lengthy one to this point. I, as mentioned, am the chair of the Land Use and Transportation Committee for Metro Vancouver and vice chair of the Water Committee. I'm working with Suzanne and many other politicians to try to bring together a sustainable region, which is a very big job. I'm also very proud of being the Canadian Secretary for the Mayors for Peace movement, which is a tremendous movement of some 2,200 mayors from around the world that are committed to ending any nuclear weapons by 2020. So it's a movement that I think is gaining more and more strength and is going to be successful. We were the first city to have the peak oil issue raised in the Lower Mainland, and you can look on our website at our report in January of 2006, which gives a lot of background information. Hopefully I can talk a little bit about that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Gregor.
I'm Gregor Robertson. I'm the Vision Vancouver candidate for mayor, and Rex told you a little bit about me. My career really got going as an organic farmer. 1990 out in the Fraser Valley, and trying to figure out how to raise food sustainably close to the city and to feed an urban population from a nearby agricultural land base, but grew into production, started Happy Planet as a way to have a brand and a vertically integrated company that delivered that goodness into more digestible and convenient forms for the urban population. And that has eventually morphed into politics somehow. I don't know how the transition happened there, but realizing that our governments weren't too focused on sustainability, were in denial of climate change and certainly peak oil as recently as a couple years ago provincially. I've worked hard as an MLA, being the Minister of Energy and Mines' nemesis in the Parliament in Victoria, and now I seek to make real change at a local level here in the city of Vancouver, making this city the greenest city in the world.
Thanks, Rex.
Andrea.
Oh, thank you. First, I'd like to acknowledge the Coast Salish peoples on whose traditional territory we're holding this meeting today and really honor and thank them for the spirit with which they approach reconciliation of Aboriginal title and rights. My name is Andrea Reimer. Rex gave me a bit of an introduction. I'm running as a council candidate for Vision Vancouver. I'm currently the executive director at the Western Canada Wilderness Committee. I am the vice chair of the Farmers Market Society. I am the former co-chair of the Food Policy Council for the City of Vancouver. I was the past president of CCC Credit Union and a former chair of the Vancouver Green Party. So as you can see from my resume, I have a strong commitment to sustainability and to relocalizing our economy in a way that supports sustainability. But I'm also very passionate about supporting citizens in getting together and making change, because I think that is how change happens. So for things like the Green Party and the Wilderness Committee, we've seen people getting together at kitchen tables and then thousands of kitchen tables and then hundreds of thousands and then millions of people across the country getting together for change on sustainability. But what's been happening is they're hitting a wall of political inaction. That's why I ran for school board in 2002 with the Green Party and why I'm now running for council with Vision Vancouver. I'm really proud to be running, to be sitting up here actually with people who've all taken significant action on environmental issues, but I'm especially proud to be running with Gregor, who I think really exemplifies the kind of political leadership we need on this issue.
When I first approached the notion that I might run for a mayor of Vancouver, so many of my friends and relatives and people who love me would roll their eyes and say, "But wait a minute, Betty, you're 80 years old. You've just got out of prison. You've just done a 7 months stay there at the invitation of the government. Why don't you go home and write your books?" Because I am a writer, and I've written 4 books on the environment. And part of me really, really wants to just do that. But the other part of me knows that my grandchildren do need me. They need me to do exactly what I am doing, which is to try to bring these two meltdowns together in the consciousness of everybody, that we have to, for an environmental meltdown along with the economic meltdown, and it's something we have never had to face before. And as an elder, I've been through hurricanes, floods, depressions, but never, ever two at a time. So we're going to have to think carefully. And I believe that elders have a role to play in this. We've had a really artificial separation between elders and the young. Thank you.
Well, my name is Mark Emery, and I typically take a contrarian point of view, and I'll do that tonight, too. I don't think government's up to the job to save us for sustainability. For example, SkyTrain didn't even work today. I mean, there were 3 weeks in the last 3 years when you couldn't shower or drink the water in this city because of turbidity. So if government can get its act together on the Olympics, on the Millennium Line, which I doubt, we're going to see fabulous overruns. We're going to see construction companies going bust like crazy in the next 2 years. The mayor of this city will be so preoccupied with increased homelessness, demands on the police, a collapse, collapsing tax base, buildings that aren't being built anymore, the whole Olympic boom ending. Believe me, we'll be grateful for oil at, you know, $140 a barrel, because it'll mean we've been prosperous. Now that oil is down to $75 a barrel, it means because our economy is tanking, and that means dire implications for the rest of us. Government's not up to this job. I believe in empowering individuals. Our company, we put water filtration system for the tap water in our building. I got rid of my car and I moved downtown 4 blocks away. Now I have a Zipcar membership. I'm testing out a Zen car with the province newspaper next week. And so these are things individuals can do. Do not wait for the government to rescue the environment, because they will screw it up like they have always screwed up. They will sell out to big business, big oil, big uranium, whatever it takes in politics. That's what they do. You'll notice that all the problems that are caused in the environment are created by government. Individuals solve problems. Government creates problems. Try and remember that when you're voting.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask the panelists to try and keep their answers brief to about 3 minutes, about twice as long as you just spoke. And please stay on topic. The more we can address the questions and avoid politicking tonight, that would be excellent, because the people that have come here are people that are interested in these issues, and they want to know what you think about how we're going to deal with this. First question that we're going to talk about, Gateway. Doubling the bridge, more highways, bringing more cars into Vancouver, and so forth. Is this a solution for our local transportation needs? And if not, what is the solution? And let's start with Mayor Corrigan.
Well, thank you, and it's probably appropriate that I respond to Gateway since the effects of the twinning of the Portman Bridge and the widening of Highway 1 will affect my city probably more than any other. In Vancouver, really the widening of the bridge and the increased highway will affect Vancouver, mainly the east side of Vancouver as traffic goes into downtown Vancouver, far less impact on the west side of Vancouver. But in Burnaby, it goes right through the middle of our city. And we're looking at an expansion of the highway to, at Willington, about 15 or 16 lanes, if you can imagine that. We now have at Willington the highest crash location in British Columbia as a result of cars coming off of Willington and looking for a way through Burnaby to get into downtown Vancouver, either via First Avenue, Lougheed, even up to the Heights and going through the neighborhood in the Heights to be able to get into the Vancouver waterfront. The situation is one in which clearly no one in the world has ever built their way out of congestion. It is an oxymoron to expect that you are going to be able to build more highway and somehow build yourself out of a problem that only increases as a result of increased highways. You only have to look at Seattle, 150 miles away, to be able to look at someone who has tried to build their way out of congestion and produced a city that is virtually unlivable because of the highway cutting through the center of their city. You know, Seattle is just as beautiful as the Vancouver area, but does it ever rate as one of the most livable cities in the world? No, never. Never in that top list. And the reason is because they've chosen highways over transit. We are not going to find a solution for the problems of people coming in from the Fraser Valley by increasing highways. What we have to do is we have to create more complete communities, communities where the jobs are available within the communities for people to be able to live and work close to where they're employed, where people can walk and bike. Right now, as a result of our development of SkyTrain into Metrotown, Metrotown is now at a 40% alternative transportation rate, which shows you it can work, even in cities that were formerly very suburban. Burnaby has now achieved a 25% transit usage rate, which is comparable to Vancouver at this point, which is, again, a result of having effective, efficient transit in our city. The solution lies with better transit, not with increased highways. And the decisions that are being made by the provincial government now are 1950s solutions. They don't recognize the issue of peak oil. They don't recognize the environmental damage. The irony of it all is the very pollution they're creating as they line up on a highway to get into Vancouver drifts down the valley into the lungs of their children in Abbotsford and Langley and Surrey, because their children are the ones who are going to suffer as a result of the pollution. So for me as mayor, this is a battle that we're going to be fighting on an ongoing basis to try to cope with the traffic that's created by a very, very damaging solution. And we hope more people will stand up against Gateway. Thank you.
Thank you. Gregor.
Thanks. I think it's, Derek has laid out a pretty explicit case against Gateway and the folly of investing billions of dollars in expanding pavement in this region, particularly when so little of our region and so little of our province is actually productive farmland. It's a tiny fraction of what we have here. So to be covering it up with fossil fuel asphalt and dooming it in terms of its capacity to produce food is really misguided. I think the case that has been made is faulty right across the board, whether it's a case for the economics of it and the goods movement, the case on the environment and the emissions side that idling cars somehow are polluting more than if we built more lanes and had more cars moving faster. Or whether you look at the social implications of basically basing our communities around car travel, which hasn't proved to be very, very positive influence on mental health or the spirit in communities really anywhere in the world. I'll just focus on the solution side of it because I think it's Derek started with the importance of complete communities. We have high growth centers around the region who are focused on more density. We will need a much more robust transit infrastructure to connect the high-growth communities. And, you know, we can't expect everyone to walk and bike everywhere within their communities. There's a lot of movement of people between centers around the Lower Mainland. We need to facilitate that with much better transit, and we have barely any transit once you get to the Fraser River. So there's a real need to develop the transit, the backbone of transit, right out to all the high-growth centers, and then ensure that we have a more affordable system in terms of the capital side, ensuring that we're not only focused on this, on the big expensive SkyTrain projects, but that we look at more economical models like rapid bus, and we actually build out a system that doesn't cost us a fortune in the short term, but is able to deal with the capacity and the demand that we have right now. So, and beyond that, I think it's critical on the goods movement side that we look, in a way, into our past. We look at bringing our rail corridors back into action. There's a lot of rail corridor in Vancouver right now that's gathering dust, and we need to be focused more on restoring our rail systems that we've had in far more productive shape. And look at things like short sea shipping on the Fraser River, rather than unloading everything at the edge of a bog and driving it across asphalt through farmland, that we use short sea shipping to bring to barge a lot of the goods movement up the river to in a more appropriate place to transfer it onto rail. So there are lots of ideas here. No doubt it's the direction we should go versus where we're headed right now with Gateway.
Thank you, Gregor. Andrea?
I am against Gateway and have been a very vocal opponent to it. Through the food policy work I do, I mean, you realize the total insanity of paving over farmland so that you can run trucks full of imported food over this new road or highway that they're building to get to us. Like, the sustainability factor is very low with Gateway. And it's a good example of how governments are very, very challenged to solve yesterday's problems tomorrow. Forget about solving tomorrow's problems today, but where we need to move to if we're going to have a sustainable region and a sustainable government. So in terms of Gateway, there's two basic issues when you're asking about solution. The first is around moving people, and why there's such a public, or why there has been some public support for Gateway, is because there is a lot of traffic congestion on our roads. That comes from a lack of investment in transit infrastructure over the years, which the government is now putting a fairly substantial investment into the sort of bricks and mortar of transit infrastructure, but we still have issues around the operating funds to be able to run those buses and those trains that we need to deal with as a civic government. You could also look at Gateway another way. The $7 billion that's being spent on Gateway on a road could have been put into affordable housing in this region over the last number of years, and then we wouldn't need this vast transportation network for people who can't afford to live in the city of Vancouver to move to Surrey or to Abbotsford or even out to Chilliwack now. We have emergency responders in the city who live in the city of Chilliwack because that's where they can afford to buy a house. So the people moving part is actually not that difficult to solve. You build up affordable housing in the city of Vancouver, you invest in transit, you create more walkable, compact communities. The harder part to solve, and really one of the impetuses behind Gateway, is the movement of goods. So when we have only half of our food in British Columbia coming from British Columbia, the rest is coming from somewhere else in the world, usually around 3,000 miles away. How are you going to move that unless you're preserving local farmland, standing up for urban agriculture, supporting farmers markets, which currently, incidentally, are illegal in the city of Vancouver? There's no legislative framework for them to exist, so it's equivalent to you or I opening up a bag on the street somewhere and asking someone if they want to buy some eggs or a chicken or something like that. So things like that need to change. We also need to preserve light industrial in the city of Vancouver and have a good economic mix so that we can start to relocalize the economy. It's not something that happens overnight, but the pieces that we do already have, we need to fight for, and then we need to create structures so that we can build the economy locally over time.
It's the Local Brown Bagger program, brought to you by CFRO 102.7 FM every Tuesday at noon. Tune in from anywhere on the net at cooperadio.org. You are listening to a panel presented by VancouverPeakOil.org on the future of Greater Vancouver as oil and natural gas become more expensive and harder to get. That adds food security as well. Panelists are Burnaby Mayor Dennis Corrigan, Vancouver Councilwoman Susan Anton, Pot Liberationist and Mayor Candidate Mark Emery, Vision Vancouver Mayor Candidate Gregor Robertson, and Council Candidate Andrea Reimer, Betty Croswick running for mayor, and hosted by author and Greenpeace co-founder Rex Wyler.
Yes, I agree with everything that has been said. Who can refute what all of the speakers have talked about? I would like to add the environmental impact there on Roberts Bank, there at the mouth of the Fraser. There are three different pods of orcas that live there all the year round. And then there are just enormous numbers of migrating birds of all kinds of sea life. It's a wonderful, incredible place that's wild. And it will be destroyed by the addition of making this just a commercial port, for heaven's sakes. So I just wanted to bring that in, that these whales and the porpoises, the birds, the resident animals and birds, the migrating ones, they're endangered. A lot of them on their endangered list. And the port will, this gateway will, for them, will be the gateway to extinction. Another thing that I would like to bring up on how to rectify some of this, in addition to the wonderful things that have been just been said, on how to ease people's lives who are trying to live in such a rapidly changing economic and environmental environment, is the workless party that took my heart was because it says zero growth, zero economic growth, zero industrial growth. We have to stop it because it's killing us. It's killing the universe and it's killing the animals, and we're animals too. And we have to learn to share, to consume less, to live more, to love more, to try to create spaces where our communities can come together, where we can have relationships between old and young people. Have I been cut off? No? I'm okay. As I don't pay attention when I start talking. And in order to do this, we have to deliberately adopt an attitude of, you know, most of the stuff we work for is not worth it if it's material things. We've got to have room to be human and to reclaim our humanity, to reclaim the relationships between ages, between sexes. Most of the stress and strain of our society has to do with an imposition of a corporate mindset that destroys the humanness in us, that makes us know we are not just feeding. We're not here just to feed an economic system. We're here to learn what it is to be human and to try to develop spiritual connections to the environment and to each other. Without this connection, our lives are just simply without grace, without charm, even without art, unless we recognize that we are spiritual beings. I'm not talking about religion. I don't like religion at all. I try to stay away from it. But what I do recognize is that I'm a spiritual seeker, like we all are. And in order to do this, we have to have time to think about it. We have to have time to converse with each other about it. We have to get away from the notion that we have to accumulate goods in order to be a success, because that's not what living is about. It's about love, for heaven's sakes.
Thank you, Betty.
Well, the $7 billion Gateway Project, that is financed about $3 billion proposed for the people of British Columbia. You know, like, we have 3,450,000 adults 19 and over in this province. So take $3 billion and put it to those people, and they're paying $850 per adult. you add on the cost of borrowing, and it's $1,000 per British Columbian for this gateway product. I mean, really, in a time of financial crisis when people's jobs are at stake and life is expensive, would people really choose to devote $1,000 of their tax revenue to the government for the gateway project in British Columbia? You know, I can't think of people in Vancouver Island saying yes to that, and I can't see the people up north saying that. I can see some farmers maybe in the Okanagan thinking that's a good idea to get the food to the city, but boy, what a colossal use of money in dangerous times. And here's the thing. Again, government's more often than the problem. You know, I'm going to test out that Zen car in a few weeks, and I can't drive it to Burnaby, so if Derek would pass a law allowing me to drive on his streets, he'd do a lot for the environment in the long run, because he'd encourage other municipalities to change their laws. And the Zen car is a Canadian invention, okay? We don't have that many Canadian manufacturing here in this country. And basically, they've been almost outlawed by municipal, provincial, and federal regulations, as well as regulations about their road serviceability. So, you know, again, I think the culprit is always government. You want to see why things go wrong? Look at the people in charge. Okay, that's where the answers don't work. Individuals will make changes and adapt when they are given the opportunity. Governments are the ones that resist and obfuscate and are inefficient, and they're inefficient in all kinds of ways. And this is another way. On one hand, we ban this Canadian invention that's totally pollution-free. It's not allowed anywhere. It was recently passed in Vancouver. I suppose I should thank Peter Ladner for voting towards that, because now as of October 1st, it's legal to drive a Zen car, and this is the only large municipality in Canada where you can do that. So again, it comes down to the little things and the little people and the little tiny things you can do. You can get one of those cars. They're only $20,000. You can change the way you live and make an influence on other people, as long as Derek over there in Burnaby lets you do it.
Suzanne.
Fairly safe to say that most municipalities will be passing that legislation fairly quickly. We were only sorry in Vancouver that we got beaten out by Oak Bay. So credit to Oak Bay. On the gateway, it is a huge project, most of which, of course, is not within our control as cities or even as a region, particularly since we've had TransLink taken away from us. We are the only regional government or only municipal governments in the country that have no control, essentially no control over transportation anymore. The Portman Bridge decision, I think, was premature. We should have had a look at how the Golden Ears Bridge functioned and how and the new Patello Bridge, which will something will happen at the Patello Bridge because the current bridge is so inadequate. And have a look at how those function and then decide what kind of and put some transit in. And then I think at that time the whole question of the Portman Bridge would have become moot. But unfortunately, the decisions were made backwards. As Derek said, it doesn't have a huge impact on the city of Vancouver in terms of the vehicles coming into the city. There may be some impact, but we actually have less vehicles coming into Vancouver now than we had 10 years ago. Less vehicles come in from Burnaby than 10 years ago, and less vehicles go into downtown than 10 years ago. So we are in a declining pattern, which is good. There are other elements to the gateway, of course, which we haven't really been talking about, namely the perimeter roads. And again, those are... They seem to, well, I don't know whether they're going to turn out or not. There hasn't been a lot of regional discussion about them. There's certainly been regional discussion about the Portman Bridge, though. In fact, Derek will recall, I brought in a motion to strongly oppose the Portman Bridge. It passed by one vote. We do need to pay attention to goods movement, but mostly we need to pay attention to transit and good transit around the region. And again, transit that is... the level of transit that's needed, which is why I'm very much in support of the next line after the Evergreen Line being the rapid transit, fixed rail transit of some sort up to UBC. We cannot move any more people along the Broadway corridor by bus. We have to go to the next step in transportation. There's a lot of push in Surrey and Langley and so on to put SkyTrain out there. That is something that can be served by rapid bus at the moment. It doesn't have to be served by a train given the level of traffic that's there at the moment. We also have to think about urban sprawl and how our transportation relates to urban sprawl. We all know that that's the problem with the freeways. The municipalities around the region are concentrating on density, but there is still a big lot of sprawl going on out there, and all of these big mega projects do contribute to that.
Thank you so much, Suzanne.
I can just, for Mark's benefit, motion at our last council meeting to get our staff report on the electric cars and accommodating them on our streets. So you'll be pleased to know that as soon as Vancouver passed the bylaw, we followed with a report on a similar bylaw, and we're hopeful that New Westminster will follow us. So at least in the core area, we'll be able to make the necessary changes. And I just wanted to comment that that no one out there hesitates in looking at the movement of goods and services being important and to accommodate the movement of goods and services. But we don't need highway expansions to move goods and services. In other cities, in the great cities of the world, whether it's New York or London, they move goods and services at night. They move it when your roads are not being used. And in fact, we even offered up to Kevin Falcon that we, why not use the high occupancy lanes after rush hours to move goods and services, accommodate them during that period of time. So the reality is that, the biggest problem, and I think Suzanne and I agree on this, the biggest problem is we were never asked about solutions. It was never discussed. We were never given an opportunity to contribute, to look at solutions. There is no expert report on Gateway. Gateway was a decision, the twinning of the Portman Bridge was a decision made by Kevin Falcon in the Empress Hotel, probably the Bengal Room, in which he decided that on the back of a napkin that the best way to get elected in Abbotsford, Langley, and Surrey forever was to allow more computers the use of the road. And that's really what the decision came down to. It's the worst example of planning in the history of British Columbia, and it's an embarrassment to those of us who work so hard to try to plan our communities to be effective and sustainable.
Thank you, Derek. Andrea, briefly.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on a point that Suzanne brought up because it reminded me that I forgot to mention that probably one of the sort of higher level thing above all the walkable communities and this and that is redemocratizing TransLink. Like there's this argument that we can't control the things we can't control, but that is how governments have got off the hook in this country at all levels on all issues for a very long time. When TransLink was taken away by the provincial government from the city's control, my organization put out more press releases and did more media comment than the city of Vancouver. And I think that the citizens of Vancouver rightly expect that our elected officials should be advocates for things that are in our best interest. And nobody understands the needs of Vancouver's transportation system better than the people who are elected to do that job. When I was on school board, I know there's arguments around local politicians interfering in provincial politics, but when I was elected to school board, it was on a mandate from the community to go to Victoria and fight for funding. We'd lost $100 million, 20% of our budget over two decades prior to that. There was an argument that we couldn't make Victoria mad, so we shouldn't really fight for this money. Well, we couldn't see what could be gained by not fighting when you've lost 20% of your budget. So we went over there. Not only were we able to stop cuts, we were able to start restoring money back in. And I think the citizens really need a city council that's willing, if we're going to solve these problems, who's willing to fight for the resources and the control so that they can make the changes that are needed.
Thank you. If I may, Mark, I need to move on. Okay, second question, food security. One of the impacts of both global warming and soil loss around the world, soil has become a strategic resource now, by the way, according to the UN, and we've always known it was. And peak oil, one of the results of this is that there's going to be less centralized growing of food and moving it all over the planet. The most resilient communities are going to be the communities that have planned ahead and can produce as much food as possible for their people, local populations. So the question here for the panelists, and we'll start with Gregor on this one, is food security. How are you, or how would you suggest that our community plan to make sure that everyone in the Lower Mainland has access to nutritious, sustainable, locally produced food over the next 20 years? Gregor, go ahead.
Thanks. Well, it starts first and foremost with protecting the farmland that we have in our region. We obviously can't grow a very significant amount of our food here in the urban environment, a couple percent at best. We have to focus on protecting the farmland that surrounds us. And it's very limited already and inundated with pressure from development. So we need to focus as a municipality, as a city, on supporting ALR and the Metro Vancouver board on the votes that take place. ALR has to be protected, and the voices of the city have to be loud and clear and calling for that protection. It is our lifeline, essentially. Likewise, with even the small pieces like UBC Farm, we have to stand up and be heard on this. These are critical pieces of our future in terms of food security. Beyond protecting, assuming we can be successful in protecting all the rest of the ALR that we have adjacent to us, we can look at the next layer out more bioregionally into the South Okanagan, into down the coast, in Cascadia, down into Washington and Oregon. That the regions surrounding us, a little farther afield, are very productive. And we should have better links, better trade links with these regions as the global economy shifts and the era of cheap energy fades. We are going to have to rely more on the production that takes place within within range, closer range, within rail range, and so those are relationships that need to be built a lot more strongly than they currently are. That border is a lot more significant than it should be. We have to strengthen our local food systems. Secondly, we've got to focus from the farmland to the mouth. We've got to focus on how we're processing. We've lost most of the processing plants in the Fraser Valley are gone. All the small to medium-sized processing plants have been lost over the last generation. There are a few that have countered that trend, but we have to do more. There has to be, again, it's more of a provincial strategy to focus on small processing and ensuring that we have that capacity locally. The Fraser Valley used to be loaded with small processors, dealing with all the vegetables that are grown here. So there's processing, farmers markets. Again, Andrea mentioned this, the importance of ensuring they have a place here in the city and that we have a strong pipeline from farm into the city. We as a city can improve our nutrient and waste cycles. As cheap fertilizer fades away, we're going to have to be able to be cycling nutrients and wastes and ensuring that we manage that locally. We should have a green box compost collecting system in Vancouver. We're way behind the times on that. That has to happen imminently, and ensuring that we manage and very efficiently manage our waste and nutrients. And last, just education and training more farmers, educating all the kids that go through the Vancouver school system about where food comes from.
Thank you, Gregor.
Okay, so this is why you should never go after a farmer on the issue of food security. I frankly don't know what more I could add. I have a couple small points. The first is the Food Policy Council, which is a 21-member citizen advisory body to the City of Vancouver City Council. It was established in 2003 by what was then the Cope Vision City Council. The NPA preserved it. It was the only advisory body that was made by the previous council that was preserved, so we were really grateful for that. It is a tremendous resource to the City of Vancouver, and currently when we bring, or sorry, I'm not on it anymore, but when I was on it, when we were bringing resolutions forward to City Council asking them to stand up for farmland in the region, we were repeatedly told that that was outside of our jurisdiction. We could not see how farmland that feeds people in the City of Vancouver was outside of our jurisdiction, and I think we need city councillors who are supportive of the citizens and the experts in our community who can help preserve farmland. The second thing I would say about food security is water security, because, of course, we need water in order for food to grow. We have the Pacific Climate Resource Consortium, which comes up. There are a number of universities in the Cascadia region, Portland, Seattle, Victoria, Vancouver, pull together all the current data on climate change impacts and adaptations and mitigation in the region. And they are predicting that our water supply in this region, even within as little as 15 years, will drop quite dramatically in spring and summer because of the loss of glacier and snowpack in the winter. So this is going to pose some very significant problems. There are other parts of the planet, New Zealand and Australia, notably, who are very agriculture. One of their major industries is agriculture, who have extremely serious water supply issues. And they've developed some unbelievably cutting-edge water infrastructure ideas that now have them farming with 90% less water than they were using before. They're redoing municipal water infrastructure. New buildings have to be completely water self-sufficient. So those are the kinds of things that we can do as city government to ensure that when farmers need water, it's available to them.
In talking about food security, I think there's a lot of people here in Vancouver right now who don't have food security. It isn't that there isn't food available. They don't have the money to buy consistently good food. We really have a two-tiered food system here in Vancouver and most of the North American continent. A lot of children are being fed good, nourishing, organic food, while other children are being fed consistently poor food that's pesticide-laden and lacking proper nutrients for children to grow. It's always comes down to how one thinks of security, and I agree with Mark to a certain extent about the government, that we can't depend on the government to grow food. We are facing a meltdown of unprecedented proportions. I don't know if you've looked at stock markets today, how they have plunged again. It's going to come down to a matter of food and a place to grow it in. We need right now to start planning for extensive rooftop gardens, for lawns. People start thinking of turning lawns into gardens. You know, during World War II, I'm originally from the States, it was these victory gardens that helped win that war. It fed in some places over half of the population was fed through victory gardens. And we're in a war right now with this, we're in economic war and an environmental war that's trying to crash in on us. Food is so extremely important. We have to think about it first. Let's guerrilla garden. Let's go out and claim empty lots. Let's turn to our friends who are experts in hydroponics and teach us how to grow this way. We need every bit of expertise that we can gather together, and we must take counsel among ourselves. We can't depend on governments to deliver to us what we need, because governments have allowed the corporate mentality that has taken over the agricultural of the world to crash it, just as they are crashing the economic system, because they have allowed themselves to be hijacked by the greed of corporations and developers over the world. So we have to say, in my opinion, and in the opinion of the Workless Party, we have to take matters into our own hands in very basic ways. And one is to think about food. If you've got a patio, if you've got, if nothing else, get some seeds and grow some sprouting beans in a jar or something that will connect you to the fact that we've got to have food and our children have to have food.
You know what I notice? There are no poor people at Capers or Choices. Organic food is expensive. It takes up 7 times more land than food made with synthetic nutrients. It goes bad on the shelves faster. There's a ton of wastage in the organic food industry. To me, if you want to know what's going to best preserve your food supply, is a job and some financial security in dangerous times. There'll be more people hungry next year, and it won't be because of any other reason other than an economic catastrophe. You can count on revenues for the Vancouver City Hall and the BC government being down about 10% next year through taxation. That is a catastrophic drop in revenues. There's going to be decisions need to be made about where that money should go. So it comes down to priorities. I say you should stop spending money, a dime, today on the war in Afghanistan. You should repeal prohibition. You should do a lot of things that would save us billions and billions of dollars so we can redirect those to where it's most important, where it's most vital, which is our economy, our jobs, and our ability to buy food and pay for food. And if you're into it, organic food is pretty expensive. Yesterday, an organic mango at Nestor's was $2.99, and a regular mango was 99 cents. So there's no doubt in my mind why the poor don't buy organic food. They can't afford it. They need affluence. You want people to buy good food? Give them good jobs. Create a system where good jobs flourish. Do we have that system in British Columbia? I'll ask you, because next year we'll be asking this question very critically. Where did all the money go? And how are we going to pay for all these Olympic overruns, these headaches we've got through the Millennium Line, the Olympics? It's just a disaster waiting. I wouldn't even want to be Gregor Roberts in the next 3 years, right? Because even though I want that job, it's because I know it's going to be a hellish job. It's going to be a catastrophe. It's going to be the worst time to be mayor of Vancouver and the premier of British Columbia in the next 2 years. And it's going to require some hard things thinking, not airy-fairy dreams about how we can make the world a utopian, greener place. Give me a break. The green we're going to need is money. That's the green we're going to need. We won't even be talking about these things next year in the middle of that financial crisis. The Olympics are here in 14 months, and it could be the worst economic time for that Olympic to be here. It's going to leave us with less revenue, a lot more debt, a lot of Olympic structures and facilities, convention centers, millennium lines. This city is ready to go down if that construction boom we're in now stops, and it's going to stop. And I'm telling you, you're going to really need to think about what your priorities are in this government at the local level, the provincial level, and the federal level, because we'll be talking a lot differently next year at this time.
Well, as they say in politics, it's all about the economy, stupid. And
who are you calling stupid?
I think Mark's making some good points. But I'm going to come back to food and the city and what we can do in the city. There's a lot of interest, obviously, in food and food security right now. Some of the things that are going on in the city of Vancouver, we do have farmers markets, and there's a very strong support for them at council. I don't know what is there some bylaw that's needed? I don't know, but whatever it is that's needed doesn't matter because we do totally support the markets. We have a number of them and are encouraging more. We have an initiative for community gardens, Peter Ladner's motion, actually, for 2010 gardens by 2010, and we're well underway towards that goal. Certainly when you drive or make your way around the streets of Vancouver, you can actually see a lot of these community gardens in little back lots and in odd places and odd and unexpected and very nice places to see them. We do have the Food Policy Council, which provides us good advice on these things. And, of course, we have a strong interest in green roofs and other things to encourage urban agriculture. We've had for quite a number of years, in terms of security of food, we've had the anti-herbicide regulation in the city. Every time you try and ban something in the city, though, it's problematic. I mean, I don't actually know why anybody needs to use herbicides in the city of Vancouver, but apparently people still do. Certainly you don't need them for any kind of backyard garden. In terms of what we can do at the region, again, I'll just refer again to the regional growth strategy. One of the people on our committee is Harold Steves from Richmond. Many of you will know him. He talks a lot about food security. He's been a farmer forever. And we were very emphatic that the regional growth strategy had to refer back to food security. So there is quite a lot of meat in the document about the green zone, and it's now actually separated into conservation zone, agricultural zone, and rural zone. As I said, it's in draft. Many of you will remember the livable region plan. You will be able to be engaged in discussions around this document over the next 6 or 8 months, and you're an interested group of people, and I'm sure and hope that you will all be part of that discussion because we'll be relying on good input on it. We do make some significant regional decisions. We made a decision about the Tawasin Golf Course the other day that I did not approve of. It was taken out of the green zone, and we're coming up to a decision shortly about the Jackson Farm in Maple Ridge, I think, one of those areas. And Maple Ridge. And that's coming up shortly. So everyone will be watching that. On the other initiatives, we're very interested in our creeks. Unfortunately, most of the creeks in Vancouver have been buried. We've got Still Creek at one end of the city and Musqueam Creek at the other. On the composting, I've been a composter my whole life and have a very nice compost heap, I'll tell you. But we are almost ready to pick up the green stuff in the city of Vancouver, but we haven't figured out the rat issue yet. You have to protect yourself against rodents, but we do have the big twig things that can be picked up. So we're moving in that direction. We just haven't quite got there yet, but a lot of interest in making that happen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Suzanne.
Could I please just add one thing? I just want to talk about the bees. You know, the bee population is imploding, and this needs some really very serious study because it's also a really serious problem here in mainland, the lower mainland, farmlands concerning bee populations. We have to have bees. There's not enough attention to pay to what's happening to our bees. We need immediate attention to that because we have to have bees for up to 2/3 of our crops. So it's a real problem. Think about it.
Good point.
The organic bees are doing okay, though. That's true. That's only bees near pesticides or herbicides are declining.
We are out of time. You can download the second hour of this panel discussion as a free MP3 from the Peak Oil page of ecoshock.org or from vancouverpeakoil.org. This Peak Oil and Politics panel discussion was organized by vancouverpeakoil.org on October 15, 2008, and recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Tune in next Tuesday at noon for more great speeches from Vancouver, Canada, on CFRO 102.7 FM, listener-supported radio for 30-plus years.